Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
Before we get started here with my special guest, real fast, coming up real soon, I'm going to be speaking in Dallas, San Antonio, and Houston, Texas. I'm doing a Texas weekend, and that is like here. And then after that, I'm going to be in Sarnia, Ontario, Lubbock, Texas, and Minneapolis. Details on all of these at sethandrews.com/events. It's good to be back on the road. It's so good to hang out with my fellow heathens, and these things are always a lot of fun. SethAndrews.com/events. So I guess the joke starts, four attorneys walk into a bar. And before they did, they joined me on the podcast. I am a fan of all four of my special guests today. They are hosts of the new We Dissent podcast. I've got Elizabeth Cavell. She is associate counsel for the Freedom From Religion Foundation. I've got Rebecca Markert, legal director for the FFRF. Monica Miller, she is legal director and senior counsel for the American Humanist Association. And Allison Gill, she is the vice president for legal and policy at American Atheists. Welcome, my friends. It is so good to have you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
The We Dissent podcast. Give a quick profile of it. This is not a commercial for We Dissent. I want to get into the insanity of humanity that is happening across the United States and your legal fights against it. But let's talk We Dissent, what it is and what it does. I guess I'll start with you, Rebecca.
Yeah, We Dissent is a monthly podcast where we discuss religious liberties at the state and federal courts and our respective organizations work to keep state and church separate. We realized that there was a void of women's voices in not only constitutional law, but also in the atheism space as well. And what we realized was that our organizations, all of our organizations, were either founded by women or are currently being run by women or both. And really, women in this movement have been doing a lot of the real tough work to keep religion out of government. And we really wanted to raise those voices and highlight the work of the hardworking women, especially the ones on this podcast.
What in the world is it like to be a state church separated First Amendment focused attorney in this climate? Oh my God.
Oh my God. Oh yeah. My flying spaghetti monster.
Yeah.
I'm doing a lot of yoga. I am doing a lot of meditation. I'm a big fan of the Waking Up app. And I'm trying to take it in small chunks. And I actually tend to lead these days with I'm a podcaster rather than I'm a lawyer. And I find the We Dissent to be both parts therapy. And, you know, we spend a good portion of it just kind of bantering and sometimes off the record and sometimes most of it on the record. But it's true. We are so lucky to have each other in this time. And the podcast kind of organically emerged by the need to have both the female voices in the space, but also to have a come to atheist Jesus about the state of SCOTUS cases.
Just a quick aside. Natalie's been talking about getting us into yoga, and I hear it's much harder than it looks. And two, somebody else recommended hot yoga. And I looked into that, and that looked terrifying.
No, I'm going to say that my experience with yoga from like growing up in California was it started off with like the hot yoga stuff, that or like Kundalini yoga, which is all kind of chanting. And so I was just like, yoga is not for me. Circle back now. And there's all sorts of just normal like vinyasa flow. Like it's kind of a workout. What I love is it's an hour where I'm trying to not think. And like someone else is telling me what to do. The moves can be hard, but like, there's people of all ages in my class. I really like the community aspect of it and like learning what people in my neighborhood do. So I think everyone should do it.
It just sounds like work. You know, I mean, there's a nacho buffet and then there's yoga. It's just, it's not a hard choice for me, Monica.
No. It's like that game Twister, you know, like where they're like, and then put your hand up here. And it's when you look at it as fun and they're like trying to balance you, it really can be.
All right.
Less like exercise, more like playing game on a mat.
Sorry for the distraction, but this is how my mind works. Liz, with all the work that you're doing with FFRF, how much of it is filing state church separation lawsuits?
Well, I mean, that's also part of the genesis of the podcast. It's that, as we're all alluding to, this is really a crisis point for our movement in the courts, along with many other civil rights spaces. Right now, the courts are not our salvation. And so even though we are still filing every lawsuit that is still available to us and trying to strategize new avenues, we're taking this collective step back and realizing that education and other types of advocacy are going to be really, really important in these next few years while we're pushing on all of these other levers like court reform and legislative change. Education is going to be a big piece. All the work we've all been doing for a couple of decades now has been so vital all along. And, you know, now the rest of the world is kind of waking up, or the rest of the country is kind of waking up to how state church separation really goes hand in hand with all of these other civil rights movements. As we're seeing the courts, the federal courts that we have now, they're the villains of this story. And it's all kind of a piece with one ideology that we're fighting on all of these civil rights fronts. And state church separation is just one of those.
Allison Gill, Liz just said something about how the courts are the villains. Have we as a nation been betrayed by the court? I mean, you feel like it's all activists now? It's all just zealotry?
I think that we, as people that care about a fair and balanced court, and I would say even maybe the Democrat Party, have not given as much attention to the courts as they've needed to over the last couple decades, and not nearly as much as our opponents on the Christian nationalist side have, because they've had a goal. Their goal is to take control of the courts and use them to overturn Roe v. Wade and use them to gain a lever and power over the country. And they've already succeeded on the first part of that. And the second part, they've overruled Roe v. Wade. And now they're working on the third part, which is to gain permanent control over our country. So it's something we really have to stop. And, you know, we've had the ability to not pay as much attention to the courts, and now we're really forced to, because we're now in a do or die moment. We really have to. We cannot ignore the ideological bias that's been building in the courts that really reached a crescendo under the Trump administration.
I feel a little bit hyperbolic when I say that I'm watching the collapse of civilization. Like, what century do we live in? Do any of you feel that?
Yeah, Monica here. I do. And I try to kind of balance it out with the sort of Steven Pinker positivism of like, well, we've made a lot of societal progress, but then all you have to do is turn on the news and it's like there's war and climate collapse and like everything. It really does feel like, and pandemic, and then there's the monkeypox and more pandemic, and then it's like all the stuff going on in our government. So it definitely does feel that way. I started feeling that way and feeling like I kept caveating it the way that you just did, Seth, which is like, I kind of feel like I'm being sensationalist, but am I? Was around the time of my Cross case when The Handmaid's Tale started becoming popular on the televised series, and the TV ads were of a giant cross in front of the National Mall while I was, you know, the cross I was challenging was only maybe 15 miles away from it. And I was just like, this looks about right. This looks like what we're going to probably be seeing in the next decade. And, you know, it was really surreal to be arguing there with Kavanaugh just being appointed and having actual protesters wearing The Handmaid's Tale garb This was circa, I don't know, 2018 before.
Well, if I can jump in, Monica, I mean, for those who aren't familiar with that, is that, I want to say Bradenton? Was that the Bradenton cross? Mm. Can you just give me a quick snapshot of what that cross suit represented?
That's right. It was the Bladensburg cross case.
Bladensburg.
And it was a 40-foot Latin cross towering over just a busy highway intersection right outside of D.C., nestled in Prince George's County, Maryland. And the government's central argument was that the cross was not that religious, that it wasn't even Christian, that it represented soldiers. It was a military cross, and it represented soldiers who were Jewish and atheists and Muslim. And we're like, sorry, what? So we actually had a lot of Christians on our side, yeah. Methodists, Adventists, Baptists.
Well, they were mad that somebody was trying to de-Christianize the cross. That was some of their protest, right?
Precisely. So this was one of those rare times where we were like, hey, hey, hey. And that's where you really start to see the shift between the Christian nationalists and like the I don't want to say bona fide Christians, but the religious Christians. And then the like power hungry, whatever this is. Like, I don't even know. I don't even think half of them really probably believe in Christ stuff. I think they're just after the power and using Christianity as the funnel. So
anybody else want to speak to this sort of national existential crisis that many of us are feeling?
Well, I can. It's Rebecca here. I mean, I definitely feel that crisis. And when we were talking just earlier, it reminded me of a headline I saw from The Onion, where they said the Supreme Court rules 5-4 to baptize the Constitution. And I retweeted that and was just like, that's not far off. The only difference is it would be 6-3. But I feel like Monica was saying, I feel like I'm being like sensationalizing things or like being dramatic. But I really think that these types of things that we think are never going to happen are happening. And it feels sometimes like we're powerless to do anything about it. And it's really hard to find the hope and what will get us out of this. But really, we kind of have to dig deep and find that light, because we really have to fight for our future. And especially for me, as a mother of four children, I want to ensure that my kids are growing up in a world that's better than what I had. And right now, I'm not entirely sure that's true.
What do we do when there's no one to go to beyond the Supreme Court? Right? If the Supreme Court has become an activist wing of Christian nationalists, at least the majority, if that's the case and they're the highest court in the land, now what?
This is Liz, and I definitely have thoughts on this. And this is something that we have talked about many times on our podcast. It's so frustrating, precisely because the Supreme Court is imbued with so much power and finality in their power that makes us all, and because, like Allison said, for so many really like generations, we have had a little bit more integrity across our institutions. And so we have been able to sort of rely on the institutional integrity of the Supreme Court and the democracy and other things that are corroding now. But because of that, it's almost like we all don't know collectively what to do or how to react when the court is completely compromised and radicalized in a direction that just most of us don't want to go. And so, you know, I think we've talked on our podcast, and it's important, I think, to remember and to kind of speak the truth of, is that the Supreme Court, yes, we have accepted its finality and its structure for all these generations because it's been legitimate. But it's important not to forget that it's just a part of our constitutional order, like anything else. And it is subject to checks and balances, just like any other part of our constitutional order. So like the things that we talk about in court reform proposals that are still not widely accepted by lawmakers, but are obviously gaining traction amongst the American people for the reasons you're expressing, which is just exasperation with the court and not understanding why we all have to just sit back and take it. And it's not written in blood or, you know, come from on high. I don't know. Everyone knows I don't know my Bible. Whenever I try to make a Bible reference, it doesn't work. It's like, it's just all in my mind. It's just Mel Brooks.
It's okay. Let the spirit move, and just whatever comes, comes, and it's going to be fine. Okay.
It's not written in the, you know, stone tablets, sure, or whatever. Sure. Their jurisdiction is not written in blood, you know, their makeup.
Do we stack the court? I mean, or do we literally say, fine, if you're going to throw Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett, et cetera, Alito, you're going to throw all these people at us, then we are going to now change the makeup of the courts.
But it's not with that attitude you're saying. It's not fine. You want to do that? We're going to do this. It's this. It's you are a court that has gone completely out of step with what the mainstream of the American people, the electorate, want our lives to look like. You are overstepping your power. You are now going to be subject to the checks that are available to the American people to check your power. There's nothing radical about that. And there's nothing vengeful about that. It's just our system of democracy.
Allison, I've had you on hold for a while. What's your thoughts?
Sure. Well, it's not just the Supreme Court, although of course that needs to change. And, you know, it has changed. The size of the Supreme Court has changed multiple times over the course of our democracy. Congress does set that number. And I've seen a lot of great ideas for setting it equal to the number of circuit courts. We are currently 13 across the country. So right now we have sort of an imbalance, only 9 people on the court and 13 circuit courts, which is not how it was several decades ago. So that could change. But also the lower courts need to change. We need to have a lot more judges in this country. And because it's been such a political football, the courts in general, they have not expanded the number of lower level courts to keep up with the needs of the American people and our businesses and litigation and everything else happening. So it takes years to get through federal court, and it's a real impediment to enforcing contracts, to people getting criminal trials in a timely way, and all sorts of other things. So there's real reforms needed, not just at the Supreme Court level, although it's certainly needed there, but at other levels as well. So I think that we should focus on all of those things together and not make it about a political revenge sort of project, as Liz was, you know, making clear, but sort of a how do we improve our system? How do we make sure it's fully representative? And how do we make sure the courts are functioning as well as possible?
Let me throw this out for whoever wants to jump in. We saw Trump's 3 appointees, and they were all being really cagey about Roe v. Wade. Well, it's settled law. Essentially, hey, you know, and there's no expectation that there will be any movement on Roe v. Wade. I mean, the courts have already ruled. They're totally playing it cool. And now, you know, the minute they've got the majority, I mean, I figured it was going to happen, but I had no idea it would happen this fast. Do you feel like there can and perhaps even should be repercussions for what they said under oath during the hearings?
This is Monica. I don't know. I mean, I feel like the whole idea of asking judges, like, I hate that we're in this position where the judge positions have been sort of politicized. Like, we do want to know what they have to say and what their stances are, but faking them into an answer kind of defies our jobs as lawyers, right? Like, I want to be able to persuade a judge to move from their position. So I don't like the idea from the outset of judges, you know, saying, this is how I would rule. But insofar as that's what we're the game that we're playing, I don't think that these folks should be surprised that there are people that are very upset and are reacting to that. Like, I don't think that they get to claim that they didn't see this coming.
But if you're not asking specific questions, how do you then guard against the activism that we're seeing? I mean, it's a weird catch 22, right? I mean, I don't want to pin them down. They need to be able to interpret. It's a lot of it's contextual, but at the same time, how do I guard against some zealot coming in and imposing their religious ideology on the rest of us? How do you get around that?
I think you can look at their record. You can look at how they've decided other cases. And we would be able to see that right away from some of these judges that, like Gorsuch, for instance, with the Establishment Clause has always been very much like plaintiffs don't even have standing, never standing. All of that's in the Tenth Circuit. So you can see where some of them would be leaning. But I don't know. That's my opinion. I think that they could ask them whether they would uphold the Constitution and the rule of law.
I mean, this is Allison. Their answers are always non-answers anyway. So it's kind of hard to sort of say what value there actually is, except for maybe introducing this person to the American people as like and trying to show their skill. And that's like more on the, I guess, on the side that's promoting them to be on the bench than the other side sort of questioning them. So it's I agree with Monica. I don't think it's realistic to sort of hold them to their answers in these areas. But it's just a political system these days. I feel like if we had more members on the court and a better system for putting members on the court and we had members rotate maybe onto the circuit courts, there's a lot of proposed fixes for how the Supreme Court should work. But any of those would result in a better system where we're not sort of putting so much pressure on every single nomination because they only come along so often and they're each going to change the balance of all these areas of the law. That's not a good system in any way. And so we have to get away from that. I think think that's the primary issue. The Supreme Court has too much power, and it's all levering on like individuals, and that they're being put there by these sort of forces.
This is Rebecca. I agree with everything that Allison said with regard to court reform. But with the system that we have now, I think the biggest thing that we can do is engage the American people in learning more about the court and knowing what they can do to influence who's going to be seated on the court. I mean, we're not completely without power. You can call your senators and let them know to vote yes or no on a confirmation. And there has been a history of nominees getting forked, like getting pulled.
Now there's a whole generation that has no idea what you're talking about. So I need some context, please.
Well, there is history of nominees being pulled because they were politically unpopular, because the views that they held were not going to withstand scrutiny by the Senate. So I think that we have to remember that we have that too, and just educating the public on what these nominations mean for the future of our constitutional rights is really important, short of all the reforms that we've been talking about before. I mean, I think we definitely need to do that, but we really need to get people engaged and not just voting, but being involved in the legislative process.
I always wonder what it'd be like to be Robert Bork. Right. He's up. He's got the nomination, and then things go south, and then he becomes an adjective or a verb, or, you know, did you get borked? You know, I mean, I feel kind of bad for the guy.
This is Allison. It's actually funny because he got a vote, a fair vote, and just lost. Unlike, for example, Merrick Garland, who was also mm-hmm. not allowed. So they gave Robert Bork a fair hearing and put him up for a vote, and he just didn't have enough votes because he was unpopular because of the political reasons Rebecca was just talking about. But unlike more recent cases where they don't even put people up for a vote any longer, it's a real difference.
What do we do about Roe v. Wade? This strikes right at the heart of bodily autonomy, especially under the shadow of, we'll call it, religious control. I mean, almost everybody, if not everybody I have seen who is an activist against Roe v. Wade is motivated by a religious ideology. They believe that they are part of a God-ordained quest to protect life, pro-life, you know. And I know some people have weaponized the pro-life platform. I think Trump easily falls into that category. I don't think he gives a shit. I think he reversed his position when it became politically expedient because he wanted to pander to the evangelicals. But now that all this stuff's coming down from the Supreme Court, how do we counter this attack on reproductive choice in the United States?
Well, this is Allison. One way is to pass the Women's Health Protection Act, which is a federal bill that has already passed the House, which would make access to abortion a federally protected right. So that's probably the easiest way is to pass that law. Now, that's assuming, of course, the Supreme Court will not undermine or attack that law. So who knows if that will hold up in the long run. But that is the best and easiest way to make sure that everybody has access. And of course, there is fighting state by state. There's already been ballot measures. For example, there was a ballot measure recently to undermine access to abortion in Kansas. It was previously found by the Kansas courts that the state constitution protects access to abortion. And so there was a referendum meant to sort of remove that protection from the state constitution in Kansas. And it failed handily. It failed by quite a lot. So that's fantastic news. But similar types of ballot measures could be used in a proactive sense in different states to make sure that basically people do have access to abortion. Those are just two examples.
And just adding on to what Allison is saying, because I think that it's really important to acknowledge that this is a massive crisis of our institutions and our individual rights. So it's not just what can we do and here's the answer. It's the improv comedy rules. It's yes and. So everything Allison said, and at the same time acknowledging that we don't accept as a society that this is not a fundamental right and that it should all just be up for democracy to just say whether or not women in any given geographic location should have bodily autonomy and the ultimate say over what happens with their pregnancies. But right now, in the short term, what we have is democratic, raw democratic power. That's what you saw wielded in Kansas, and that was so encouraging. And there are so many different democratic ways to shore up women's access to reproductive care. And by the way, funding on the ground efforts to get people access that need it right now, right? Like, this is an issue that affects people who are pregnant as we speak, with a ticking time bomb of a clock in most places across the country where, you know, abortion access is becoming vanishingly shorter and shorter periods of time during your pregnancy. So, I mean, there's the on the ground grassroots funding, helping resource abortion funds to help people that are suffering now. There's wielding the raw democratic power that we have to put these rights into statutory effect. And then there's also acknowledging that the long-term solution here is I want to live in a society, in a governmental, a civil society where reproductive freedom is a constitutional right. Like, I believe that that is a liberty interest that's protected by our constitutional values. And so we can't accept that that is just going to be the future, that all we have is democratic power. I think it's yes, and yes, and yes, and there's just sort of so many, you know, there's like a triage version of what to do after Roe. And then there's a long-term version of how do we get there?
As we see cultural opinion, though, I mean, these massive protests around the homes of these specific majority justices at the Supreme Court. How do you all feel about that? Obviously I'm opposed to any sort of violent or even illegal behavior, but just being there, showing up in numbers with your signs and your placards and having your voices heard.
This is Monica. I'm of two mindsets. Like, I, on the one hand, I think I alluded to earlier, feeling like they shouldn't be surprised that that's the reaction. And insofar as it remains nonviolent, you know, and it's showing the outrage, the due outrage that women feel and people in our country feel over the loss of serious constitutional rights, I think that's great. But I do sometimes worry about playing into the hand of like the crazy snowflake liberals, like in terms of what's more productive use of time. Like, I do feel like calling your congresspeople and that kind of thing could maybe be more effective in terms of change. But I do think it's also important to show in some form or fashion. I just don't, you know, like, it reminds me of the time that someone rammed into one of the Ten Commandments monuments. I mean, it's not the exact same thing, but it, like, you know, it wasn't even one of us. I think it was a Christian guy that just did it.
Yeah,
but
it
kind of reflected poorly on us, in the sense it's like, we're just going vigilante rather than through the courts, even though atheists didn't do it. So, you know, I think to me, I tend to be less harassing, if that's the way to say it.
Yeah, I can't. This is Allison. I can't speak to the efficacy of it. Like, I don't know how effective it is in the long run. However, if they're going to act like political decision makers, and let's be really clear, this was a lawless decision. There was no reason for this decision. It was not based on any change in the law or facts. I mean, I think the dissent in the Dobbs case really makes clear that this was a political preference decision by these justices. And if they're going to act like lawmakers, then there's no reason not to sort of protest them and treat them like lawmakers, except also they're not accountable like lawmakers. We can't unelect them. So there's some, I understand why people are frustrated. I understand why people are protesting them. And I think it's appropriate. I don't know how much impact it will ultimately have.
I understand the frustration. Is there any merit to those reports that came out that certain Supreme Court justices held a prayer before the Roe vote? Anybody else hear that one? Crickets.
I guess I'd be surprised if they did. It's kind of like, shocker.
Yeah. All right. Well,
right is the least surprising thing of all time. Yeah. But also, I do think there's so much more to the corrupting influences that have been going on over the past whatever years of the Roberts Court than we know. And this is just me living with Andrew Seidel, who researches this stuff like constantly and just is uncovering more and more since the publishing of that story, which kind of piqued the interest of a lot of us who do this work, who are like seeing these Christian liberty legal groups that we are often opposing counsel with in a lot of our cases, that they actually have seriously corrupt relationships with some of these groups. And I think in some cases, individual justices via these groups. I can't remember the name of the group that was doing the prayer and the meetings in that article that you just referenced, Seth. But
yeah,
I think it's probably like, without getting too into like unsubstantiated whatever I'm just like overhearing Andrew ranting about, I do think it's not hard to believe that Supreme Court justices are conducting themselves with like that level of impropriety. And it's probably worse than that.
Andrew Seidel, of course, a constitutional attorney and author of the book, The Founding Myth. Coming up with my special guest, Elizabeth Cavell, Allison Gill, Monica Miller, and Rebecca Markertz, attorneys and co-hosts with the We Dissent podcast, I'm going to talk about the apatheists. Has all of this insanity rallied you and me, the common folk? Have these zealots and Christian nationalists and this sort of activist court, has all of this actually motivated the people who are now going to stand up and oppose them? Have they lit the very fires that are going to burn them in the ass? I want to talk about this and more next. Hang on. I'm so thankful for your support on Patreon. And if you're not a patron, you get the show early and commercial-free, and I so welcome your support. Patreon.com/SethAndrews. Continuing my conversation with four co-hosts and attorneys of the We Dissent podcast, Monica Miller, Rebecca Markert, Allison Gill, and Elizabeth Cavell. It used to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, back when Falwell and the Moral Majority, et cetera, were doing what they were doing, and then we get into the 21st century, they're really trying to Christianize this secular nation. But they used to be, in my opinion, a lot more subtle. You know, they maneuvered their language a little bit. You didn't hear, well, we are Christian nationalists. They didn't throw it out there. And now, they had Ted Cruz and Marjorie Taylor Greene and I mean, all these, and they're proudly wearing it on their sleeves. They're shouting it from the rooftops, Christian nationalists. They don't care. And people seem to be responding to that, raising tremendous alarm. Anyone want to speak to those two words, Christian nationalism?
So, yeah, this is Allison. Christian nationalism is, you know, it's a term that we've used to talk about this group of people for a while. It's not a group of people. It's more an ideology. So we're not talking about Christianity or a particular religious view or even a subset of Christianity. We're talking about an ideology that says basically that America was founded as a Christian nation, is still a Christian nation, and it should be a Christian nation. Anybody who's not Christian is not fully American. And basically, the do not believe in a separation of church and state. They believe that Christians have a right to sort of rule America. And so, you know, that's vastly different than what the Constitution actually says and what most Americans believe. And, you know, there's great research on this topic by Dr. Andrew Whitehead. It really shows that Christian nationalists they have a very us versus them mentality, and they're very, unfortunately, maybe more prone towards political violence than other groups. And so we saw this when it came to January 6th, and we're definitely seeing it more and more as this ideology takes hold and becomes more visible and becomes more vocal. We're seeing more of this sort of violent tendencies. We're seeing more of this identification as Christian nationalists. I think the older Moral Majority, that might have had less Christian nationalism in it and more like evangelicalism in it, if that makes sense. There might have actually been a shift over time in this way. At the same time, the actual research that I've seen shows that Christian nationalism is actually diminishing in our country. So it's kind of interesting how it's more visible, but it is slightly gone down over time.
I have noticed the power of fear to sort of motivate and galvanize. When I was a devout Fox News evangelical Christian, I lived the most privileged life imaginable, and yet I was convinced they're all coming for me. They're coming for me and my freedom and my faith and my guns, you know, and there's so much utility in this type of messaging. And we know that the zealots know this. The socialists are coming to take away you, and the abortionists want to kill your children. They're all a bunch of mustache twirling villains in the operating rooms. And, you know, it's 8 months and 29 days and 11 hours, and they want to take your baby. And it's just this constant fear language. And there's a whole demographic that just laps it up. And then fear becomes galvanizing, and then they decide it's a holy war against a perceived enemy. I'm terrified. I genuinely do fear political violence beyond January 6th. Does anyone else share that fear for the months and years ahead?
This is Rebecca. I definitely share that fear, too. I think just even recent news events with the raid at Trump's home in Florida, the Twitterverse is going crazy. There's a lot of conspiracy theorists out there about that. So I don't think that we are free from future political violence. I'm really concerned about it. What makes me more scared and also just incredibly sad is just how I can find some friends and family members also in my orbit who have sort of fallen for a lot of these things, not just the people who are refusing to get the vaccines and the people who downplay COVID, and then all of the other people who have followed Trump over the last 5 years. I mean, it's really easy for people to glom onto what they're selling. And even people that I know and love and have respected before, and how that could just change so quickly, and how suddenly, you know, we could not be friends anymore because of something like that. And I just really worry about the future. And I do think that we're probably prone to more violence before the end of all of this.
I mean, they feel like, I really feel like many of these people lean into authoritarianism. This is more of a philosophical observation. I'm talking here with four co-hosts of the We Dissent podcast, we-dissent.org. I will throw that link as well in the description box. I highly recommend following the work of these four legal minds, heroes and legends all. And I'm so glad to call them friend, but I'm more than that, just glad that they're out there on the front lines, because this is really an exit. You know, I like the way Andrew Seidel says, what's happening now is an existential threat to our democracy. I mean, would all of you agree with that? Like, we're on the bubble.
This is Allison. I agree. But I also want to say we can maintain our democracy. We must maintain it. But if we do, in the long term, we are winning demographically. You know what I mean? Like, religious Christian nationalism is decreasing. Non-religious people are increasing. Over time, younger people are more accepting and tolerant. It's a matter of time. I think we're seeing a dying movement trying to cling to power, and we have to make sure they do not destroy our democracy in the process.
That's probably why the courts have been weaponized the way they have, and political parties are battening down the hatches because they realize they're losing the culture war.
I mean, I'll just say, again, to plug our podcast, come listen to We Dissent for, like, comrades in the trenches. We are people that are still working to push against these forces, but also calling it like it is and reckoning with the huge task in front of us. And it's important to understand and to call out the fact that our democratic institutions are in peril. And that has to be part of the fight now. It's not the fight from 10 years ago. It's that fight, and it's a new fight. So, okay.
Final question. We'll just stop on this question. Do you feel like Roe and all these other things that are happening from the Supreme Court down, and the Christian nationalist and these wackadoodle politicians like Marjorie Taylor Greene, et cetera, do you feel like it's kind of motivated people? I mean, we see a lot of people who are apatheists. You know, they just, it's all broken. I don't care. I'm not engaged. Do you feel like that's sort of all that's happening now, all this insanity, is helping to engage people? Have you taken that sort of temperature?
Well, this is Rebecca again. I do think that it has made people more engaged and active. I think that we've seen that since 2017, after Trump was inaugurated with the Women's March. And personally, I thought, I'm not sure how long people can stay angry, because anger does breed activism and change. And I wasn't entirely sure that that was going to be sustained through 2020. And then it did. And I think it hasn't really slowed down since either. So I do think that people are less apathetic and they're really motivated to stop this. I think one of the things that I always fall back on is that now's our time really to build for the future. Our job, particularly as attorneys, but I think everybody's job right now, is to register that dissent and to make those dissenting arguments so that the next generation, which I really truly believe is the one that's going to save us from this crisis, I think we need to put those building blocks out there in the form of dissent, so that when they are in power and they are running this show, that they are able to take all of our work and make it their reality.
Elizabeth Cavell, Rebecca Markert from FFRF, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, Monica Miller with the AHA, the American Humanist Association, and Allison Gill with American Atheist. On top of we-dissent.org, I will put the links to those specific organizations in the description box. Your work is necessary and appreciated, and I'm so glad you joined me here. Keep it up, and we'll support you however we can, okay?
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Seth.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter for a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions. Log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.